This is Indie Book Publishing. Indie Book Publishing is a show about new books and the authors who wrote them. It's an opportunity for prospective readers to hear directly from the writers, to hear what inspired them to write and publish, and to hear all the inside details about their books. And now, Indie Book Publishing with your host, Steve Jorgensen.
Greetings for Steve Jorgensen and Indie Book Publications. This is J. Douglas Barker. Today, we're going to be visiting with author Sharon Hollander to discuss a very fascinating topic, and maybe one that might be a little scary. Medical Billing Horror Stories is the title of her book, and I welcome Sharon to the program today.
Good morning.
Good morning. How are you?
Good morning.
You're in California, so it is morning.
Yes.
Let me ask a couple of questions about your book. Obviously, this is about some scary things that have happened in the medical industry. Your background and training, what was that?
I've been working as a president of a medical billing company for close to 20 years. And in that capacity, we submit claims to third-party insurance companies on behalf of physicians.
I was just going to say, this is an independent office, an independent company that you're associated with.
Correct.
The book itself says these are anecdotes and real case studies ripped from the headlines about what doctors did, which got them into trouble, either with Medicare, HIPAA, the Office of Inspector General, or worse, the FBI. So these can be some pretty remarkable stories.
Yes, well, there's the full spectrum. You know, certainly there's the physicians who are not intending to do anything or any wrongdoing and end up, because of billing irregularities, get flagged for either a Medicare audit or they're not following rules. And then the full spectrum goes all the way to physicians who intend to defraud the government and what happens to them as a result of not following these rules. And so what I did was I outlined the medical billing process so everybody could understand what the steps needed to be taken in order for the provider to submit claims to the insurance companies and how they get reimbursed. And then issues that have come up common to some of my clients and some consulting projects that I've worked on in the past, as well as, I said, some of the physicians that, you know, were in the headlines because of terrible things that they undertook.
Now, in writing this book, would you say this book is written for the consumer or for the medical professional?
Initially, it was written for the medical professional, but I'm finding that more and more consumers that have been affected by being a patient or are interested in the healthcare, with all the changes upcoming with Obamacare, it seems to have a much wider appeal than just physicians.
You have 248 pages. Would you refer to this as maybe an easy read, or is it a little complicated for the off-the-shelf consumer?
It's actually an easy read because of the way that we formatted it. So we explain the rules and regulations and then give actual case studies, so it's easy to follow along.
Describe the process of writing your book. How long did it take to get all of your facts, figures, and information together in book form?
There was a very heavy amount of research that was needed to do this book. But that being said, I actually managed to finish it in approximately 6 months, which is quite fast for a book of this size.
That is amazing.
I had a lot of stories that were just bursting at the seams to come out.
And do you have any anecdotes from your book that stand out that might be really attention grabbers?
Well, there's one story in particular about a physician's office. He hired this secretary, I guess, to do his medical billing, and she inadvertently transposed a digit on the diagnostic code that she submitted.
Ooh.
So instead of submitting claims with anxiety, she sent the claims in where the patients had leprosy.
Oh my.
And it took the doctors almost a year and a half to come to the understanding why his claims were constantly being denied and why he kept being flagged to have a Medicare audit. And it wasn't until he got on the phone with Medicare and jumped through a bunch of hoops until he was able to get the response and found out that his claims were all submitted with patients having leprosy.
And does this type of thing happen very often?
Yes, unfortunately it does.
And is it because of untrained people who are in the assistance and help category in the doctor's offices, or is it something
it's
else?
It's a combination of non-training. Sometimes it's just a clerical, you know, transposition of a number. Sometimes it's that the rules and regulations change so rapidly. Right now, Medicare has about 130,000 billing regulations.
Oh, my goodness.
So it's very difficult for the average physician to sort through all those and do everything correctly. And just when they learn it, then there's a new change. something else will come down the pipeline and tell them they're not doing it correctly.
How do you keep on top of that?
Carefully. It's very time-consuming. But we get emails, and we're on the website with Medicare constantly. We go to seminars as much as possible. And the main thing is, what happens is if we submit a claim and there's an error on it, we have software that will identify the error before it gets transmitted. And then we have great communication when we're evaluating the explanation of benefits that comes back from the insurance company to see what the error was and then avoid it. Educate the doctors as we go along to say, okay, this code is not acceptable with that code. This diagnosis needs to be with that procedure. But the doctors can continue to practice quality medicine, and we deal with the business aspect of it.
It sounds like a labyrinth just waiting for an accident to happen.
Definitely. And as the volume of claims, Medicare processes about 80 million claims in a month.
In a month?
Yeah, I think so. I have to check on that statistic. I believe it's a month.
That's even if it was half of that in a year, that's an amazing amount of paperwork and things that could go wrong.
Well, Medicare mandates everything to go electronically to avoid paper. So there are softwares in place to alleviate errors, but that's not to say that they don't happen on a regular basis.
And how would you introduce this book to someone who doesn't know that much about the medical billing industry and the potential for fraud, abuse, and accidents?
Well, it's interesting for any patient who goes to a physician because they're on the receiving end. 85% of all medical bills actually have errors on them, including the hospital bills that they receive. So it's in their advantage to, you know, review and understand the medical billing process just briefly so that they can see when they get a copy of their explanation of benefits back from their insurance company, they can determine if there's any errors on it and try to troubleshoot. You know, the example that I gave you before about the doctor that his staff sent in the code for the leprosy, how it came to his attention in the first place was a patient contacted him and said he was denied for a pre-employment physical because there was something in his file that said, you know, that they weren't going to insure him, they weren't going to employ him. So the patient was the one that actually brought it to the attention of the physician in the first place.
Amazing. And that's under EOB, I guess, is the short form for Explanation of Benefits.
Correct.
Wow.
Yeah, because every patient that goes to the physician and has insurance will get a copy of the Explanation of Benefits.
It's important as a consumer to pay attention to the details, even if you're not a detail person.
That's correct.
Are there any other mistakes or errors that really have stood out in your mind in your research?
Well, there was one lady that she was working for a hospital in New York City and decided to take some of the medical billing claims home with her to work on it, I guess, over the weekend or something, and inadvertently left the billing records on the subway, and the hospital ended up getting fined $800,000 because of the HIPAA violation. You're familiar with HIPAA. HIPAA is the Healthcare Privacy Act that ensures that nobody will reveal your medical records. And if you're a famous person, your medical records are not going to show up on the Internet. It's part of the HIPAA requirements. So physicians and hospitals are mandated and by law required to protect what's called protected health information. So any personal information, diagnoses, or, you know, your social security number can't just be floating out there in the world at large. And something is, you know, innocuous is just leaving your briefcase on the subway. Ended up being a huge repercussion for both the provider and that individual. Lots of examples of individuals who violated HIPAA by, you know, going, you hear often celebrities will go into a hospital in California and everybody's on guard, like to find out what their medical condition was or what happened to them. And so they have, most of the hospitals have huge safeguards to prevent a patient or a disgruntled employee from snooping around in medical records that they're not privy to. And one individual was doing that and looking up celebrities on the computer, and he actually got 4 months jail time for it.
And the fines, how large are the fines when something like that takes place?
They can go anywhere up to multi-million dollars, depending on the size of the organization.
That's incredible.
But at the physician level, you know, it's a couple thousand dollars. It could be more, depending on, you know, it depends on who is alerted, who's affected by it, who complains about it, and, you know, what the penalties are, vary from case to case.
Well, how would you introduce this book to someone who maybe is not that familiar with what's happening in the medical industry?
I would tell them that this is a really good overview of the process, and it's interesting because of the way it was presented, so that it's, you know, to take a topic like medical billing and turn it into something sensational and exciting. Not an easy task.
I'm sure it isn't. Is it exciting enough to maybe make a movie of the week out of, or is it just basically good, solid information that people need to know about?
I would say both. I mean, I don't know about a movie of the week, but certainly there's some evidence of other medical shows that were based on nonfiction. You know, typically they take a medical show that's based on, you know, a murder mystery, or, but this is particular cases of, you know, billing. It's kind of like accounting. I don't know how many people are going to sit and watch a show on accounting. But that being said, you know, the penalties and the situations that have arisen that have caused these doctors to get into trouble in the first place are quite fascinating.
And you do have stories about doctors actually being incarcerated.
That's correct. Mm. Yeah, there's fraud cases. What happens is the doctors decide that, you know, they're not happy with the Medicare reimbursement. I'll give you for instance, there was a psychiatrist who was not happy with the Medicare reimbursement. She felt that her charges for her time and care with the patient exceeded what Medicare would allow for it. So what she decided to do was bill Medicare Monday, Wednesday, and Friday for the patient, even though she only saw the patient on the Monday.
Mm.
So basically, there were 2 days a week where she was falsifying medical records because the patient was not in attendance and she was billing for an office visit. And did this for years at a time until they got caught. She actually ended up losing her medical license and got convicted of fraud. And I believe there were penalties. There wasn't exactly jail time for her because I guess it wasn't as huge an incident. There's been cases where physicians have taken kickbacks from hospitals or other organizations, and they've gotten into trouble. And I'll just give you a fraud case, somebody that actually went to jail.
Yes. In reference to that, the medical pharmaceutical reps.
Right.
Are there issues related to that that might be a danger point for a doctor?
Yeah, here's an example. A physician conspired with his wife to obtain hydrocodone, which is a prescription painkiller. He provided the prescriptions to himself and his wife and former patients, and then they filled the prescription that he was taking for himself.
Wow.
So narcotic pain medication, what's called Schedule II controlled substances,
yes,
like oxycodone or methadone, those are pretty highly regulated, but what happens is the physician, you know, prescribes it and then ends up taking it for himself. Or they falsify records in order to fill those prescriptions for stolen patients.
What one thing would you like people to take away from this work?
I would like them to take away that this is a very new and upcoming issue that's being presented, Medicare now, because of Obamacare and all the changes in healthcare. There's going to be a lot more physicians in the next, I would say, 2 years, where every single provider in the United States is going to get audited by Medicare.
Ouch.
In some fashion. So it behooves them to learn this information and be aware of what the correct way to do the billing is and the consequences of not doing it correctly.
Do you foresee a growth in the medical industry as far as doctors, physicians, and specialists?
I do, because 29 million people at this point are at this time and space, they're uninsured. And because of that, once Obamacare comes in, if and when it does come in, these patients will have health insurance, and they're going to show up at physicians' offices. Definitely a demand, especially for primary care at this point.
And you grew up in Canada and have your education from University in Toronto.
York University in Toronto.
York University. Do you see any or have any concerns about the way the Canadian health system has diminished over the time of usage to what might be coming down the pike for the United States?
The United States is never going to be, in my opinion, on a socialized medicine, because the patients mandate that they want care and they want access to care. And we have the difference in the population. The entire population of Canada is at least 26 million, and the population of Southern California equals about 26 million.
So about the same size.
Right. And Canadian geography, as you're aware, is quite larger than the United States.
It is.
So that being said, I just don't see it happening anytime soon. But, you know, they've tried different models with the HMOs and Kaiser and some other larger HMOs. New York and Massachusetts, I believe, tried to implement some socialized medicine, but I'm not sure it worked.
Canada, most of the problem, I think, is overutilization. As a Canadian, I am a Canadian, and I have some concern. I've got family members that are in that system, and the main problem is overutilization and no penalties.
Well, I have to say my parents still live in Toronto, and my experience is that they get excellent care, especially during an emergency. And their perception, though, is that the Canadian health care is free. They don't realize they're actually paying for it through taxes.
Correct.
It's just a misperception. But the downside is, for things that are non-emergency, there is a significant waiting period. My mother once had an MRI. They told her that it was scheduled for 3 a.m. in the morning.
Oh, my.
And I was there visiting. I said, what, are you guys crazy? And they said, well, that was the only time they had available. They work at the MRI machine 24 hours, and she had to wait about a month to get an appointment, and then they gave her one at 3 o'clock in the morning. But they get quality care.
Yes.
Whenever there's an emergency, they're taken in right away. So there's a trade-off, right?
Absolutely. With any benefit, there's a trade-off. What was the most challenging part of writing this book?
I would just say consolidating the information and presenting it in an entertaining and informative manner, that it was easy to understand and interesting to read.
Well, again, the book title is Medical Billing Horror Stories, and the author is Sharon Hollander. Thank you, Sharon, for visiting with us today.
Thank you.
And how can we get a copy of your book?
You can get a copy either at my website at SharonHollander.com or at Abbott Press, spelled ABBOTTPRESS.com. Also available in all the major retailers, Amazon and Barnes & Noble.
Excellent. For Steve Jorgensen, Indie Book Publishing, and Abbott Press, this is J. Douglas Barker.
You're listening to Indie Book Publishing, and we'll be right back after these messages.
Hi, everybody. This is Pete Dix of Beatles and Beyond. Why don't we all come together and hear some of the tracks off the latest Beatles release on this radio station? Why don't you look up the schedules on this radio station and join me and Beatles listeners everywhere to hear these latest releases from the Beatles on Beatles and Beyond with Pete Dix.
Connect with Juliana and connect with what lies beneath. Friday afternoons at 4 or 3 Central on TogiNet.com. Juliana is a marriage, family, and child therapist who wants people to connect. Connect with what lies beneath those truths and answers. And through her counseling practice, she has helped others find their personal power and fulfill their dreams. And she wants to do the same for you here on Connect with Juliana. Through intimate discussions, intriguing subject matters, and the expertise of her guests. For more on the show and Juliana, check out her webpage. Connect with Juliana in media.com. Juliana will cover it all. Nothing is off limits. She wants to know what matters to you. Make the connection. Tune into TogiNet to connect with Juliana to find out the facts that could be hidden beneath the surface. Connect with Juliana on TogiNet to make a quality connection in your life. Friday afternoons at 4, 3 Central on TogiNet.com. Welcome back to Indie Book Publishing, helping authors publish, promote, and sell their books around the world. Now, back to your host, Steve Jorgensen.
Greetings for Steve Jorgensen and Indie Book Publishing. This is J. Douglas Barker. Today, we'll be visiting with author Titus to discuss a book entitled Job Satisfaction in Higher Education. That's a challenging title, and it's put out by Trafford Publishing. Good afternoon, Titus.
Good afternoon.
Explain yourself. This book looks very complicated. Is it a difficult book to read?
No, I think it is a fairly simple book to read. It's a book on job satisfaction of teachers in universities, in higher education, we say. It is about a subject called job satisfaction, trying to find out how satisfied they are with their jobs. This occupational group has been identified as opposed to some other occupational groups, and the intention is to find out how satisfied they are with their jobs. Their job is not a simple one. Academics work within the university. Their primary jobs are teaching and research, and the aim of the book is to gather the research opinions relating to their satisfaction levels in performing their primary duties.
So primarily this is aimed toward educators.
Yes, the book is primarily aimed at educators, but I suppose some other professions might have some similarities and differences with the situation in higher education. But primarily, the book is aimed at educators.
I noticed a lot of graphs and charts in your book. Would that make it more complicated for the regular reader to understand?
No, there are simple graphs in the book, simple tables and graphs, but I've tried to avoid complicated equations, regression equations, multidimensional scaling. There are much more difficult things which I did during the research, but which I did not include in the book in explaining it to the general reader. However, some of the tables that there are and the graphs are simple ones, and the book itself explains these tables and the information contained on the graphs.
Well, how did you come up with the idea of writing this book? What is your background, and how does it apply to your writing skills?
I have degrees in business administration. My first degree is in business administration. My second degree is Master of Business Administration, MBA. And my doctorate is in management and administration. So I am well equipped, to write on topics in business generally. And this book I've written from my research into the subject in the university. As I've said, teaching and research are primary duties of an academic worldwide, and we are paid more or less to research topics in our areas of competence and interest, and to teach students, graduate students, undergraduate students, courses in those areas. So the book arose from my research studies on the topic and the findings, which are very, very interesting. As research is one of my primary duties, initially I wrote articles on several aspects of the topic of job satisfaction. Then later, a book in which various research views are contained appears to be the natural progression of what I wanted to do. This is particularly the case as I found that there are paucity, there are absence of books, recent books on the topic. Available few books on the topic are very dated. And there is the importance, the perceived importance of the topic as it affects our feelings and actions in higher education.
You've also focused on administration and management in this book.
Yes.
And what did you find?
administration and management. Well, administration and management, some people would regard as one of the duties and responsibilities of academics. That is in addition to teaching and research. Academics perform a variety of administrative duties within the university, and it is regarded as their primary, as one of their jobs, not necessarily primary jobs. Within the university, you find some academics, in fact, appointed to be the head of some units, appointed to be the dean of some faculties, appointed to be the research coordinator, seminar coordinator, and advisor of students in a particular department, and various other administrative duties within the universities which only academics know perform. And so it is regarded as one of their responsibilities. Indeed, some people do get appointed as head of academic departments, deans of faculties, directors of schools, vice chancellor, if you like, it is an administrative job within the university, which is different from teaching and research per se, but it is also regarded as, you know, one of their primary responsibilities, because, you know, the organization, that is the university, has got to be administered and managed well for professionals within it to be able to teach and research properly.
Well, how important was compensation? How big a factor is that in job satisfaction?
It is very, very important. I did a survey in which I tried to find out the satisfaction of academics to aspects of their job, and, you know, the model I used to arrive at overall job satisfaction, we include satisfaction of the academics on their teaching, research, administration and management, their pay, their promotion, their co-workers, supervision, working conditions, and physical facilities. So there are a number of factors that are important in estimating their overall level of job satisfaction. An individual may be very satisfied and competent at teaching. He may be less so with research. Some other people might prefer administration and management, managerial duties within the university, and they might not be particularly good co-workers. Some functions are performed jointly, like in the departments. Some research are even conducted jointly. I remember I have done a number of research studies along with some friends or some colleagues within university, so that co-workers' behavior, promotion, present pay, administration and management, research and teaching are aspects of overall satisfaction. So what my research did was to gather the satisfaction of academics on each individual variable and then sum up the lot in a total package of overall job satisfaction. Many academics appeared not to have been very happy with their pay and promotion system within the university. It's one of the findings I made, that, you know, academics are not satisfied, are not as satisfied as they would want to be with their present pay and their promotion system. And the book, of course, tried to explain what may be wrong with, you know, these two items. The promotion, for example, within the UK, some academics are really qualified in terms of the quality and the quantity of research publications which they've made, in terms of the number of years they spent teaching and researching, but they do not get promoted to professorial levels, and some of them are not happy because of this. And, you know, but the government might say they have no money to promote everybody that is qualified for promotion, and so on and so forth within the university system. So many variables, and the academic has to perform on all these variables in order to have overall job satisfaction level that is high. The way I try to do is, in the research itself, there are seven parameters. I measured job satisfaction, and to job dissatisfaction, there are scales 1 to 7. 1 measures extremely dissatisfied, whereas 7 measures extremely satisfied, and 4 is neutral, neither satisfied nor dissatisfied with an aspect of the job. And I then try to find the averages and see which of the variables that academics are most or least satisfied with. And the information in that is very, very revealing, that indeed some academics are not satisfied at all with their promotion and pay within the university system.
And how long did it take you to do this research and get this book assembled?
It took some years, 3-4. The primary research itself took some 3-4 years, because it's not just one research. You know, initially I started by writing academic papers on various dimensions of the topic. I might start write a paper on the job satisfaction, general features. I might write a paper on classifying academics based on their job satisfaction levels. I might write a paper on trying to explore the relationship within job satisfaction and gender. That is, I might ask, are the women more satisfied or less satisfied? On what does age have to do with job satisfaction? What does rank, the individual's rank within the university, has it got an effect on the overall job satisfaction? How about the length of service they've put in higher education? Is that one reflected in how satisfied or dissatisfied they are? And can we have profiles of university teachers based on their levels of job satisfaction? And I tried, you know, to answer each of these questions, you know, in my book, devoting some chapters for, you know, interesting dimensions, just like, you know, profiles of university teachers, where I tried to group university teachers into 3. There are those I regard as happy workers. There are those I call satisfied workers. There are those I label unhappy workers. The happy workers constitute about 2/3 of the population, 67%. The satisfied workers, about 14%. The unhappy workers, about 19% in higher education. And, you know, I carried out a cluster analysis, you know, to separate these groups and find out what actually distinguishes one group from another in terms of, you know, the result of my cluster analysis. And the results are very interesting to the general reader that, these happy workers are totally different from the unhappy workers in terms of their satisfaction level. There are statistical means that you can use to distinguish, to differentiate between categories of academic leaders, academic workers, based on their satisfaction or dissatisfaction levels.
Now, would your book mostly appeal to the academic community?
It will, but hopefully it will also appeal, definitely it will appeal to academic community, but hopefully it will appeal to managers and people having connection with the university system, government, funding bodies, agencies connected with it, looking at the success of universities, funding bodies, for example, would be very interested in how academics feel, how satisfied they are, what makes them tick, how they can improve, you know, the performance within higher education.
And also how to motivate their workers.
Yes. Motivation, the workers, if they know the variables that, you know, are important, then the question is, how do they make sure that these variables are positively, you know, in place such that, you know, the academics will be motivated. For example, when I talk about, you know, present pay or promotion or, you know, there is a lot government can do regarding this, making sure that anybody that meets the academic criteria of teaching and researching at a high level will get promoted. You have got to find the money to sustain the interest of such individuals, because, you know, the society will benefit, you know, from the research studies which they conduct, because their research studies will be on the environment, you know, where they live. And so the government it would be the interest of the government to make sure that, you know, they do not have policies that will tend to dampen the interest of the academics in what they do, because what they do is for the society as a whole.
Now, was the research and gathering all of the facts, was that the most difficult and challenging part of this publication? Or was there something else?
The research design itself is very, very challenging, but the write-up itself is as challenging, because there are various dimensions. You've got to be knowledgeable about these dimensions. For example, dealing with the analytical bit, if your background in quantitative analysis is not particularly good, you will not be able to write some chapters at all, because it requires a lot of regression analysis, very many quantitative methodologies to say what you want to say to the general public.
Your book again is titled Job Satisfaction in Higher Education. The author is Titus. Titus, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you very much.
And where can we get a copy of your book?
Oh, it's with the publisher.
With Trafford House?
Many copies, I suppose, with the publisher of the book.
All right, very good.
Which is Trafford Publishing.
Excellent.
Trafford.
Trafford
Publishing.
It's spelled Trafford.
Yes,
and do you personally have a website?
Yes.
Do you personally have a website, sir?
I do have a website. It is www.titusushagbumi, by first and second name together,
And how is that spelled, your last name?
osHAGBEMI.co.UK/index.html.
Excellent. Well, I'm sure many of our listeners will want to get a copy of your book and expand their understanding of higher education and job satisfaction. Thank you for sharing this important information with us today.
Thank you.
For Steve Jorgensen and for indie book publication Trafford Publishing, this is J. Douglas Barker.
You're listening to Indie Book Publishing, and we'll be right back after these messages. Join us for Self-Aid Success Stories with Helen Wu, Wednesday nights at 10, 9 central on toginet.com. Helen Wu was born and raised in San Francisco's Chinatown, and after a very difficult upbringing, fighting depression, abuse, and addictions, she finally finds herself genuinely happy inside and out. Helen believes in taking our positive thinking and doing something positive to achieve a positive outcome. She's here to make a positive difference in your life, to be your game changer, your aha moment mentor. She's ready to help both men and women get into a better place. Helen Wu is also the author of Self-Aid Success Stories, 25 Success Stories from Successful Entrepreneurs. Inspired by Ellen DeGeneres, Helen wants the world to know that just because we find ourselves in a difficult situation doesn't mean we have to stay there. We can aid ourselves to a better life. So join us for Self-Aid Success Stories with Helen Wu, Wednesday nights at 10, 9 central on toginet.com. Welcome back to Indie Book Publishing, helping authors publish, promote, and sell their books around the world. Now, back to your host, Steve Jorgensen.
Greetings for Steve Jorgensen and Indie Book Publishing. This is J. Douglas Barker. Today, we're visiting with author Dr. Kathy Stewart and discussing her book titled Hebrews. It's not how you start, it's how you finish. This released through Westbo Press. Good morning, Kathy.
Good morning, Jay, and thank you for having me.
Delighted to talk with you, and this is an interesting topic and certainly one that I believe is religious in nature and a Bible study format from what I have been able to discover in my perusing the book.
Yes, it's a Bible study and a question and answer format designed for the layman.
Well, you have a very interesting background. Pharmacist, you've taken religious study degrees at the Liberty University, also have a degree in Christian education from Southwest Bible College and Seminary in Sulphur, Louisiana. What motivated you to be so education-oriented?
I guess because primarily I wanted to be a great Sunday school teacher. I was interested in education and in learning more about the Bible itself. When I came out of school, graduated from pharmacy school, I taught youth in my church, and then later on I worked with children, and lastly I worked with some adults, and I just wanted to become more knowledgeable in those areas, and I just had this desire to teach, felt that I had the gift of teaching, the spiritual gift of teaching from the Lord. So I guess that was, you know, it just all kind of snowballed, one on top of the other, and that's how it all came about.
Your first degree was in pharmacy.
Yes.
And then you pursued your other interests in Bible study and Bible teaching.
Yes, that's correct.
How is it you chose the book of Hebrews as your focus on this book?
Well, it's my favorite book in the Bible, even more so than the book of John or Isaiah or Revelation. I would describe it, well, of course, my title is, it's the most encouraging book in the New Testament because it is so Christ-exalting. You cannot help but see Jesus in his superiority as a person and in his ministry. And yet, as the Son of God, of course, he became the Son of Man in the flesh, and he experienced the temptations that we did, and yet he overcame them and triumphed over them, and he's enabled now, as in his high priestly ministry, to give aid and comfort to those who need it so that we can endure the race that we have and finish our course. In other words, we can make it no matter what circumstance we face.
Well, there are some controversies about who the author of this book actually was. What do your studies tell you?
Well, there are generally two camps that it's divided into. One is that Paul wrote it, that it could be, and there are certain indications in there that he may have written because he came from a Jewish type of background. And there's a scriptural reference to milk and to meat of the word. But my personal favorite candidate, if I were to nominate an individual, would be Apollos. He's spoken of in the book of Acts, I think it's chapter 18, as a man, Jewish man who came from the city of Alexandria, which is where the Septuagint came from, which was the Greek translation of the Hebrew Old Testament. He was very eloquent in the scriptures, and he loved to refute the Jews publicly, particularly with regard to the person of Christ. And he has become my favorite candidate for having written this book.
Factually, the author of the book of Hebrews doesn't matter as much as the message, does it?
No, it does not. It does not influence the message in any way.
At least not in a negative way.
No.
But tell me something about your career in pharmacy. What are you doing currently?
Well, currently I'm acting in a firm that we service nursing homes. So we take care of medical needs for our elderly people. And, you know, the elderly population is growing in the United States. So they have a great many needs, particularly with regard to prescriptions and medications. When I went on there, it was a 15 years ago. I have to admit that the primary reason I went on there was it offered better hours, you know, so I would be free to lead some Bible studies on my own time. So the scheduling worked better for me. But I've come to really like certain aspects that I've learned, like working with IVs that you don't see in retail, consulting in the nursing home. I did that for a little while, looking at patients' charts, doing evaluations. So it's like you learn something new every day from the experience, and it just has kind of evolved over time.
Do you feel like your study of Bible history and content has assisted you in your current career?
Well, I don't know whether it's been an extension, but it's been good for me. I've been, you know, I would have to say the career overall has been good for me. It's given me freer time than I had in retail, a better schedule, and I can lead Bible studies and pursue other interests that I am interested in.
One of the scriptural references in the book of Hebrews also involves a mystery that was in the Old Testament, a high priest whose name was Melchizedek. What did you discover about him?
Oh, I love the character of Melchizedek. He's just so fascinating and such a delightful individual. Now, some people think that he was actually an incarnate form of Jesus prior to his incarnation in the New Testament.
I've heard that talk.
But I don't happen to share that belief. I think he is a type of Christ by his action, because he was both a king and a priest. The translation of his name means King of Righteousness. That's the literal translation of his name. But he was king and priest of Salem, which is an old derivative of Jerusalem, and that means he is also the king of peace. So in so very many ways, he depicts actions that Christ had. For instance, he blessed Abraham. Abraham, who was a great individual himself, paid a tithe to Melchizedek when he came back from this battle of the kings. So he gave him a tithe. And, of course, Melchizedek blessed him, brought him bread and wine. Of course, we know that eventually Aaron was a descendant of Abraham. So, in a way, Aaron's priesthood was blessed by Melchizedek. And so Aaron represents the law. You know, he mediated the law in its aspects. But Melchizedek existed before the law came into being. So he is sort of the greater individual, the better person. And since we have no record in Genesis of his parents, which is highly unusual in the book of Genesis,
That's true. We don't
have any lineage. We don't have any record of his death. It's almost like, figuratively, he still lives. Like, figuratively, he is eternal. So we can extrapolate from that the eternal high priesthood of Jesus that is shown in the book of Hebrews. You know, Jesus lives forever in his priesthood, in the order of Melchizedek. He's a priest, says in the Psalms, "Thou art a priest forever, according to the order of Melchizedek." Now, not according to the order of Aaron, but according to the order of Melchizedek. So he lives forever. He does not need a lot of other little priests around to serve him there. He is just the supreme high priest to serve in that office.
It's one of those scriptural mysteries that probably no one knows the exact answer to, but has created a lot of opinions, and most of them are pretty good.
Yes.
Now, Kathy, there's another term in the book of Hebrews, Ebionites. Who in the world were they?
Okay. The Ebionites were a Jewish/Christian sect in the early century of the church. They lived prior to the time of the destruction of the temple in 70 A.D., and they were strict followers of the Jewish faith, and they participated in Jewish practices such as male circumcision, observance of the Sabbath, eating kosher foods. But they were light years ahead of their fellow Jewish people in that they believed that Jesus was the Messiah. Now, let me tell you, they believed that Jesus was not a divine son of God, that he had been conceived in a sexual union between Mary and Joseph, but that God adopted him at his baptism. And Jesus was the most righteous man who ever lived, and he fulfilled all that God wanted him to do by dying on the cross for the sins of the world. So as a reward, God did raise him from the dead.
Now, there are some current religious beliefs that are similar to that, aren't there?
Yes, there are. There are some adoptionist religions around there. Now, with the Ebionites, because they believe that Jesus had been sent by a Jewish God to the Jewish people in fulfillment of Jewish law and Jewish scripture, they felt that in order for Gentiles to be saved, they had to become Jewish. So this put them directly at odds with the Apostle Paul, because Paul preached that Gentiles could come to salvation by faith alone.
There was some of that controversy in the book of Acts, if I remember correctly.
Yes, yes. Paul was always having to defend his position as an apostle to people. Now, they revered a person known as James the Just, who was head of the church at Jerusalem, and who is believed to have written the Epistle of James. The only book in the New Testament canon that they accepted was the Gospel of Matthew, because it was targeted to a Jewish audience and explained how Jesus had come in fulfillment of Old Testament scriptures. But, of course, they deleted the first two chapters of Matthew because it spoke about the virgin birth of Jesus, in other words. So they're a fascinating little group of people that existed at that time. But they did not exist after the destruction of the temple.
In 70 A.D.
Yeah, it was more or less Orthodox Judaism and Christianity that came out of the ashes of that destruction.
A composite religious approach to the birth and ministry of Jesus Christ.
Exactly.
The book you've written could be described as an in-depth Bible study on the book of Hebrews. Who do you think this book is going to appeal to and why?
Well, I think it's primarily going to appeal to those that have some struggle in their lives, and that's really who the target audience that I was aiming for, that they are struggling perhaps in their faith, or they're dealing with a personal issue in their life, the way that a person finishes their race is as important to the Lord as, like, say, exercising a spiritual gift, like, say, of teaching or of evangelism or of exhibiting fruits of the Spirit, like, such as love, joy, or peace in their character. It's unfortunate today that so many people just don't end well. It could be because they're disillusioned with their pastors or with their churches or with Christianity in general, or maybe they're struggling with some kind of personal issue that they feel they just cannot overcome, but they have to hang on no matter what. And if they do hang on, if they finish well, then as a result, I think they will receive a true eternal blessing.
Kathy, what was the process in writing this book? How long did it take you to complete it?
Oh, well, it took me about 2 years to complete this project. I have to admit that writing does not come easily to me, Jay. This was my first book that I'd ever written. Now, I've always enjoyed writing. I had this sort of burning desire within me to write ever since I was a teen. I took a creative writing class in school and wrote short stories, and I served on the school newspaper. And then later on, I submitted book reviews to the local newspaper. But this was the first book that I had attempted to write, and I was just bound and determined that in my lifetime I would finish one book and get it published. But I had what I guess you would call it writer's block, and in which I wouldn't even touch or pick up a piece of paper or go on my laptop for several months. I would get to a certain point, I'd be writing along, and then all at once I just couldn't seem to go further, and I would stop, and then I'd say, no, the whole theme of Hebrews is it's not how you start, it's how you finish. You've got to finish this. So I'd pick it up again, go for a little while longer, then I have another block, and I'd go several months, and then finally I did at last complete it. But it did take me about 2 years altogether.
2 years.
Yes.
Well, it's not how you start, it's how you finish, and that would focus on chapter 11, the faith chapter.
That's exactly right.
What did you take away from chapter 11?
From chapter 11, well, oh, bless your souls, the Old Testament saints that are listed in chapter 11, they all had their problems that they dealt with. It was not easy for them by any means. And they never saw the earthly fulfillment of their hope. They never received a true earthly reward. But nevertheless, they persevered. And they're an example to all of us. Again, it's not how you start, it's how you finish. Which, by the way, I need to tell you how I came by the title of that book. That title that was actually adopted from an old show tune that Shirley MacLaine sang and danced 2 years ago on a television variety special. But I never forgot it. It stayed in my mind, and it really does fit so well with the overarching theme of Hebrews. That it is not how you start, it's how you finish. You have to complete that race. The Christian walk is not a sprint, but it is a marathon. And we have to follow Jesus' example that he set when he completed his race, and now he sits at the right hand of God the Father. So he certainly finished well. So we have to do it. As Christians, we must complete our race.
And how would you introduce your book to someone that has not even heard of the book of Hebrews and may not be a Bible scholar or a student?
Well, maybe they're not a Bible scholar or a Bible student per se, but everyone suffers some degree. They may be going through a divorce. They may have lost a job. They may have had a death in their family. Everyone experiences some trial within their life. And I think this would provide them with some encouragement. And that's really what I want to do, is encourage people to hang in there. That's the most important message. If nothing else, I want to get across.
A great message to pass along. The book title again is Hebrews, It's Not How You Start, It's How You Finish. The author, Dr. Kathy Stewart. Thank you, Kathy, for visiting with us today.
Well, thank you, Jay. I enjoyed it.
Where can we get a copy of your book?
You can get it from www.westbowpress.com. It's also available from Amazon.com, Barnes & Noble, or any online book dealer.
Excellent. Thank you for sharing this inspirational book of faith. Again, the book title, Hebrews, It's Not How You Start, It's How You Finish. Great words of encouragement.
Oh, thank you, Jay, for having me.
For Steve Jorgensen and Westbow Press, this is J. Douglas Barker.
You've been listening to Indie Book Publishing with your host, Steve Jorgensen. Join us again next week at noon Eastern as Steve interviews another great author.